Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Lisa Simeone. I've been jealous of Alice Furlow for years now, though I've met her, and she's a delightful person. Actually, we went shopping together and had dinner at the Inner Harbor in Baltimore, her hometown. This was many years ago. We had a great time. I remember she was looking for a silk skirt. Well, but anyway, I've always been jealous of her. Why? Because she lived in Paris. Alice Furlow is a journalist. You may have heard her voice during one of her many quirky commentaries on NPR or one of her documentaries here on Soundprint. She's been telling tales of France for all these years from her base in Paris. Beautiful, incomparable Paris, where I've always dreamed of living. How could I not be jealous? But several years ago, Alice left Paris and came back to live in the USA, specifically to a family house in New England, loaded with memories. It's been an adjustment, as she tells us in today's program, which is called At Home on Cape Cod.
Ocean waves at Ballston Beach and chimes from the Bayside Town Hall bring me memories of my Truro childhood summers. The chimes have recently been silenced. They kept some newcomers awake. But their sound, chiming the quarter hours, still floated across the nearby marshes on a very special day in May 1952. That was the day a tall and divinely handsome screenwriter called Max Furlow asked me to marry him on his first visit here. He proposed on the hill above my family's old house. And one spring day, I went up to revisit that very private landmark. Now here are some huckleberry bushes, which are practically waist high. There's a house. I hope it isn't right on the actual site. And he said, "Allie, will you marry me if I can never afford it?" Or words to that effect. And it was, oh my goodness, terrific. And he didn't have a single bean. And I was 22, and he was 27. Now I'm feeling slightly teary. This hillside has changed dramatically since 1933, when my parents bought our old yellow Cape Cod house, where we spent so many summers. I was 3 years old then, and until I was in my teens, there were no trees, none at all. The hills all around here were covered with cranberry plants. They were lovely to spring around on, and you could see Cape Cod Bay from our backyard. Now huge locust and pine trees shut out the sea view. They also shut out the trophy house next door, a good thing. When Max and I moved here from France in 1997, we left half our possessions in Brittany, not sure if we could make a life here, he as a writer and psychologist, I as a journalist. But Max died on March 3rd, 1999, barely 2 years into this experiment. His funeral was in the Truro Congregational Church, with only those who loved him there. One of them recorded it.
Son of my soul, O Savior dear.
During the hymn, "Son of my soul, thou Savior dear," I felt Max, I almost saw him, just above my left shoulder, laughing, because I'd chosen the hymn of his school. It was the only tune he could sing on key, and he used to sing it in the car. Mr. Roscoe, the clergyman, wanted me to talk about Max. I couldn't, but I gave him something to read.
I'd like to add a few words from Alice Furlow here. You all know Max's great originality and sweetness of character, but few here know much about his talent. 2 years ago, he contributed a biography to his Princeton 50th reunion book. He did it reluctantly at my insistence. He left out his 3 wartime years in the Marine Corps and begins as follows. I went first, to my astonishment, into the film business, propelled there by the eminent Princeton critic and poet R.P. Blackmuir. I remained in the movies for a quarter of a century, got married in Philadelphia to a particularly delightful girl named Allie Nelson, lived mainly in Manhattan where I was born, and wove new friends into my being. During that period, I won about a dozen documentary film awards, saw my plays Biscuit and Fitz produced off-Broadway at the Circle in the Square, and was for 3 years chairman of the Playwrights Unit of Actors Studio. My next quarter century began with the surprise of my life, the calamity of self-knowledge, which transformed my existence and Allie's into a pilgrimage through what Aristophanes, had he been alive and well, would have called Cloud Cuckoo Land.
It was curious to hear a clergyman reading Max's words about that calamity of self-knowledge. That was one of Max's attempts to describe his enlightenment experience, which included a visit to heaven. That transforming experience began on March 3, 1968, lasted about a week, and I always think trailed clouds of glory around him for the rest of his life. I recorded him at age 69, remembering the part about heaven.
Well, my impression is that it's a big bureaucracy, huge, and it's beautifully run, and everything is perfect. And there are different levels, and the archangels have their own levels, their own hierarchies, and so on. And that everything is perfectly run, and the only thing that upsets everybody is, in heaven, is what the people do. If there's a great disaster here on earth, so then they all rush around, and it's all slight disorder, or great disorder. Because they want everybody to be all right, and sometimes the world is such a mess that they can't.
Now that Max isn't central to my Truro life, I don't feel rooted here, even after 7 long years. At times, I've been tempted to move back to our beloved France. Talking to all sorts of friends about Cape Cod, ancient and modern, has helped me make up my mind. Chuck Walker and I were remembering the year when we were both 14, dancing in square dances in the Truro Town Hall.
We also had dances at the post office, didn't we?
At the post office, it was this rather small room where we had a wind-up Victrola, and we played Cleve Woodward's records, Tommy Dorsey, and
and Begin the Beguine.
Yes.
Smoke Gets in Your Eyes.
Yeah.
Oh, it was terrific. It was very sexy.
Nothing fancy about those old summers in Truro. When we came, most of the people in Truro had been born here. Now, they're vastly outnumbered by summer residents, lots of them rich people with huge cars and huge houses. My old friend, Sis Mooney, is definitely not one of them. She was born here.
They come to Truro and buy an old house and turn it into a trophy house, and then they leave. So maybe that's good, I don't know. One lady wanted a traffic light down at the end of our road because her friends had gone to P-Town one night and got crocked and got in an accident, so she wanted a traffic light up there. And I said, you people make me sick. You come down here, and I don't know what you come for, and then you want to bring all your trappings with you.
That's the way I feel about the Cape a lot of the time. But then talking to another friend, John Worthington, I feel differently.
In spite of all the houses on all the hills, in spite of all the roads, in spite of the crowds, Truro's just as beautiful and just as endearing as it was when I was a little boy.
For me, the most endearing thing about Truro is this house. My parents and Max loved it. Chuck Walker hadn't been here for a long time, so I showed him around. Now, what time is it? Three something?
Maybe not even quite three. But...
Now, the clock. It has been the life and soul of this living room. Ever since 1934, my mother must have bought it. I don't believe it was here when we came. And she was the only one who knew how to wind it. I just wound it, and I don't think it's going to stay wound. Well, in the kitchen, here is something I use every day, which is a funny little metal tray my mother got. It, for years, it had the price tag, 50 cents. And Max, who used to bring me early morning tea every morning, climbing up a very narrow stairs when we were here, and he called it Tray Gentil. The next room was the parlor. And then this is a portrait of Max as a Marine by his godmother, Aunt Olive Pell. And he was very, very good looking. And there's this very narrow little bedroom. It was Max's when he began to get ill. And my parents both died in this bed. And on the bed is the most sentimental of all my treasures, my cat, Miss Pudding, who loved Max, and she's asleep, looking about half the size that she normally has been. A wonderful, wonderful, sweet cat. And she's asleep on one of his sweaters. And that is Max's watercolor of his enlightenment experience, which is impossible to describe. And there's a portrait of me, and then there's...
That's a blue. You're the blue lady, right?
Yeah. You and Stafford were the two Wellfleet boys.
Yeah, we were rivals. Stafford Fraser was my best friend, but it stopped when it came to you because we were both in love with you.
Oh, come on.
That's true.
Good heavens, this is a revelation to me. Because Nan was infinitely better looking, and I always thought
she was cutesy. She was cute.
I thought she was assigned to you somehow.
Well, I when I saw, I was a losing battle with Fraser.
Oh, gosh, old friends with memories like that of 1944, when you're white-haired and wrinkled, are well worth sticking around for, aren't they? And wait, Chuck Walker's younger brother Daniel gave me another surprise.
And I was in love with you desperately.
Oh.
And you were in love with Van Johnson.
How does you remember that?
Because when you were in our house one time, you it was noon or something. And so you faced the West Coast and did a salaam.
I said,
this woman is the most wonderful woman I've ever seen. And in fact, your features and your looks have been my standard of beauty or sex appeal since those years.
Now, before I get puffed up with pride about my adolescent years, let me not forget that from about the age of 13, I was madly in love with Toppy Worthington. Oh, Toppy's mother was one of Truro's greatest characters. She was a towering Englishwoman called Tiny. Toppy's brother John and I remembered her. Do you remember your mother singing, "Chase me, Charlie,
yeah.
Chase me, Charlie"?
Yeah.
Come on.
But the big one during the war was, this is number one, and the fun has just begun.
Roll me over, lay me down, and do it again.
Roll me over in the clover.
Roll me over, lay me down, and do it again.
And I carried that right to number 15. This is number 15, and I've given up the teens.
Mothers dominated the Truro summers in those days because fathers could only come on vacation. This house reminds me more of my extravagantly hospitable mother, Sylvia Nelson, than of my father, Frederick Nelson. It was she who'd bought all these funny old samplers and rocking chairs and things to suit the house. My father was very shy and very funny, and I always thought almost a saint. He'd been a much-loved journalist, first on the Baltimore Sun, and then on the Saturday Evening Post. Animals always loved him. But he died before our cat, Miss Pudding, came along. That's Claudia Goldstein, Miss Pudding's best friend next to me and Max. Miss Pudding was a very fearful cat, a real fraidy cat. She adored Max, and she wasn't even afraid of his walker or his wheelchair. He used to say, "Hello, beauty," when he spoke to her. She hid when anybody came into the room except Max and me, but she loved Claudia, and Claudia had never had a cat in her whole life.
Pay attention to me now. There.
No, she's paying attention to the food.
Well, the thing is, I want to show you the new way to feed her now. Now she likes big chunks of things, and she likes to see the can. See, here is wellness. This is health food, Kitty. It's health food, see? Turkey.
Oh, my goodness.
This is turkey formula. You give her.
Let me try. Here. Oh, is she a happy cat? Oh, Weddington, would you like a little more?
She doesn't play anymore.
Oh, she used to play goalie. She was a terrific goalie. You'd
roll
pitch
the ping pong ball.
And she'd bat
she'd
it out
get
of the
under
chair.
A chair wanting us to roll the thing. Mostly, the people who know Max as a therapist are all in France, which is sometimes I feel a reason to go back there. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't go during the lifetime of Miss Pudding, but yeah. And yet here there's you.
Mm-hmm.
And you loved him.
When did I come here? In 94, and yeah. I met Max in 95 after my husband died suddenly. And Max was a terrific grief therapist for me. He literally saved my life. He was fabulous. He did a gestalt therapy. We actually, we had our sessions in this parlor room. And I'll never forget some of the things he taught me. I've often wished he'd been around for Ali's grief of his loss, because he really was terrific. He really was amazing, amazing man. Yeah. He loved this house so much. Yeah, he always talked so fondly about you, Ali, even when we were having a session, you know. He'd talk about Ali, and at that time I didn't know you. We'd never met. And there was just an amazing connection that you guys must have had, because I could just tell the love that he had for you and the...
Max was a very, very dear and special person. I remember when
our friend Chuck Walker was our family lawyer in olden times.
I was respectful of Max. Oh, I remember when my first job as a lawyer, and Max complained to me. You were living in New York with Max, and he said Louis de Rochemont owed him a lot of money, something like $10,000, which in 1900 or whatever the date was. It was a lot of money.
Louis de Rochemont, the independent film producer.
Right. And so I said, well, we'll do something about that, Max. He said, can you? I said, I can. And I wrote a firm letter to Mr. de Rochemont and said it'd be necessary to take further action unless we saw some coin here. And he sent off a check.
No.
And I handed it. You've forgotten this?
Yeah.
And I handed it to Max. And Max was overjoyed, and he said, this is just what I needed. I'm taking Ali to Paris. And he did.
Oh.
And the $10,000 must have lasted for 30 years, because you never left.
How too lovely. I keep thinking of going back to Paris. One of Max's clients there,
calls me almost once a week, and it makes me homesick for the French language floating around me in the streets. But friends here are lovely, too. Daniel Walker, for instance. He's an actor and a founder of the theater in Wellfleet, the next town to Truro. He never met Max.
Let me quiz you on one thing. Because it's a missing part of your story that I never really had. And that was Mr. Furlow.
I'm so glad you mentioned him.
How did you meet?
Well,
because I saw a play that he wrote that was about him and you on the beach.
That was Phipps.
Yes.
It was Sam Waterston's first appearance on any stage.
Oh, yes? Really?
Frank Orsaro directed the plays, and it opened in a newspaper strike. Typical of Max's luck.
Yeah, luck, right.
There were two one-act plays. Biscuit was about a dog, and John Harkins played the dog. He was fantastic. Biscuit had this wonderful set by Eugene Lee, absolutely beautiful, and Fitz had no set at all. And it had Sam Waterston and Sally Kirkland doing all the sounds, like the flapping of the sails and the cries of the seagulls.
There's all the difference between two people having an affair, two star-crossed lovers valiantly striving to avoid the death scene at the end of the last act. Because that's what it is, you know. When a girl like you, who hasn't got an independent income, marries a guy like me, who hasn't got it made, it's the death scene.
Talking to my old friend Danny Walker about those plays makes me wish my parents had bought a summer house in Wellfleet instead of Truro. And the Wellfleet taxes aren't half as outrageous as the Truro taxes. Just right here where I'm standing, it's what I would consider an unbuildable lot of 3/4 acre. They've assessed this whole for $344,400, almost $350,000. Actually, I can't imagine anybody buying it except maybe some enterprising sports people might buy it to make it into a half pipe for snowboarders. It would be terrific. It goes right down and then just a few feet and then back up. The thing about the tax people up at the town hall, they're so adorable. They're all cat lovers and cat rescuers. And there's one called Mrs. Coco who has a wonderful cat called Phoebe. Mrs. Coco up at the Truro town hall is such a wonderful person. But the town hall always reminds me of the fact that the first time I danced with anybody was in the Truro Town Hall when I was 9 years old. My partner was a famous anarchist called Carlo Tresca, who was later murdered by Stalin in Central Park. But he was really part of the Wellfleet left, not the Truro left. The Wellfleet left is really hardcore left, or it used to be anyway. And now, Wellfleet is as famous for its oysters as for its politics. Max preferred the Wellfleet variety to all others, even when he was teaching me how to open oysters in Paris.
To get in here, to get it in far enough, and then to cut the little mussel.
It's so mean.
As soon as you've cut them, you just wait how mean it is. It's awful.
It's cruel.
And then when you cut the mussel, you break the little hinge in the back with the knife by turning the knife like that.
Is it still alive?
What the French do is they don't cut the other end of the mussel, but the Americans cut both. This is the system I was taught in Cape Cod by the neighbors. So now cut the bottom the way I do it.
Is this the Wellfleet way?
This is the from Cape Cod, Massachusetts, where the oysters are a lot bigger.
There simply was no one at all like Max. That's why it's so very difficult to think of an epitaph for him, even after 7 years. I've bought the gravestone, but I just can't decide what to put on it. Maybe this is what's keeping me in Truro, much as I miss France. It could be something from Emerson. Max was a hardcore Emerson admirer. A quote he liked, it went, I think, "Whoso would be a man would be a nonconformist." For my parents' joint gravestone at the old Truro Congregational Church, I chose a line from the Episcopal Marriage Service, that ye may so live together in this life, that in the world to come ye may have life everlasting. It's perfect for them, but not for us, who were a much wilder and woollier couple. Still, it was read over us at our wedding by my clergyman grandfather. Max and I talked about that wedding on the occasion of our 45th anniversary. Do you think those two thin people who walked up that aisle a half a century ago, would they recognize us?
But maybe they wouldn't hardly recognize me because of my Parkinson's disease, because of this sort of blur, the kind of blur in my speech.
What would you say to that young couple that, strangely enough, seems to have been us, if they came into this room right now?
I love you. That's what I say to them. And you're really a marvelous couple. And you're both original, and not like other people, and romantic, and innocent, and okay. And you're going to get by okay.
I'm not sure if I am getting by okay. Since I began this story, Miss Pudding has died. She'd become a skeleton of a cat, valiantly stumbling up her carpeted steps to bed. My hope is that now she's with Max, and that someday I'll join them in that strange, well-ordered heaven he told me about all those years ago.
At Home on Cape Cod was produced by Alice Furlow, with production assistance from Katie Gott, field engineer Brian Morris, and studio engineer Jared Weisbrot. This program airs as part of My World, a collaboration with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's program Out Front and editor Neil Sandel. The series aired with support from the National Endowment for the Arts. We have the rest of the series archived on our website, soundprint.org. In fact, all our programs are archived there. That address again is soundprint.org. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. We love getting your emails. Keep them coming. I'll be reading some on the air soon, so don't forget to include your hometown and the station you use for your Soundprint fix. The address to contact us is talkback@soundprint.org. CDs of Soundprint episodes can be purchased. Give us a call at 1-888-38-TAPES and we'll mail out your favorites. That number again is 1-888-38-TAPES, or you can order online at soundprint.org. Soundprint is production assistant Nkechi Mogekwu and audio engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Lisa Simeone.